This is Molly Hemingway, encouraging you to listen to my favorite podcast, Issues, Etc. Every day you get in-depth interviews with host Todd Wilkin asking expert guests substantive, thought-provoking questions on all of the important news and issues of our day. The expert guests are in culture, law, ethics, philosophy, theology, and apologetics. Expert guests, expansive topics, always extolling Christ. Issues, etc.
It doesn't get any more American than religious freedom, that topic. It's more American than apple pie and hot dogs.
The whole sexual revolution requires so much propaganda. They require propaganda because what they are advocating is not sustainable naturally.
The writers and the producers of contemporary Christian music are not ashamed of their mysticism. They are mystics. They're proud of it. They're not trying to hide it. If you said, hey, that song is mystical, they'd say, thank you.
And I think the Ascension shows us very clearly that heaven is our final destiny, but that heaven is already here among us because Christ is among us, and he will never leave us or forsake us.
Swedish Lutheran lawyers love Issues, etc., while bike commuting to work in Stockholm, Sweden. Thank you, America, for supporting Europe in this very hard time.
I don't think it's pure nostalgia for someone my age, born in the mid-60s, for a life when things were normal, when most of society was not only normal, but it actually supported normalcy. That is not true anymore. Now, to be normal, or what was normal in those days and for most of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century, is now considered weird, not only backward, but maybe even radical and extreme. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, June the 14th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about a normal response to feminism with Peachy Keenan, author of the new book, Domestic Extremists, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. We'll spend some time with Dr. Ken Sherb in part two of our retrospective on the Lutheran battle for the Bible, and then its media coverage of the annual meeting of the Southern Baptist Convention. A big story coming out of there. Saddleback Church in Southern California officially and resoundingly dismissed from the Southern Baptist Convention. Terry Mattingly of Get Religion will be our guest. Peachy Keenan is a married mother of five children in Southern California, senior contributor for The Federalist and contributing editor for The American Mind, and author of the new book, Domestic Extremist, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. Peachy, welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Why do you describe yourself as a domestic extremist?
Yeah, I mean, the title is a little bit of a play on words. The left looks at a stay-at-home mother with a big family, especially if you are a Christian, as some kind of domestic terrorist or extremist. But I like to say I'm not a domestic extremist. I'm just extremely domestic.
How did you become a domestic extremist?
Well, domestic extremists are made and not born in my case. I did not grow up like this. I was raised by secular atheists in the West Coast of California. You know, I went to private schools. I graduated college as a fully formed pro-choice, liberal, feminist. And it took me, you know, through my 20s to sort of discover that I had gotten everything wrong. And I managed to somehow eke out a marriage and family just in the nick of time. I mean, I like to say I escaped feminism by the skin of my teeth. And it was really by just becoming a mom and becoming a mother and realizing, oh, this is what I want to do, that I became a little more extremely domestic over time.
When you say that they have taken almost everything from us normal Americans, who are they?
Yeah, I talk about that in my book. People ask me, who is this amorphous they that you're talking about? I mean, what I'm really referring to are the groups and the organizations that seem to be conspiring against families, against normal people, people who want to raise their kids the way that they grew up, in what used to be considered, you know, non-controversial ways, having a monogamous marriage, having more than one or two kids, avoiding long stretches of promiscuity and dating apps. These things used to be non-controversial to choose to live that way, to go to mass every Sunday with your family. And now living that way feels fringe and extreme and like hard for people to even understand. Like, how can you live that way? And so I think that, you know, becoming extremely domestic is actually the only way for us to really save the culture and save the country.
Why is the establishment left so very interested in our children?
Yeah, I didn't really finish answering your other question of who is they, but it is the establishment left, and who that includes are all the people who seem to be in charge. I mean, everyone from the university professors, everyone in the mainstream media, and these government officials who keep kind of putting together policies that make it really impossible for us to raise a family, to afford to raise a family, to choose to stay home with our children. And this is the fruit of feminism. This is the fruit of many decades of liberal feminists kind of tearing all this down. I mean, this is no secret. And here we are, you know, they've kind of succeeded. I look at Pride Month, it's kind of like all the parades are really, those are victory parades. They sort of won phase one of the culture war. We're now left to sort of figure out, what do we do now? How do we raise families? How do we rescue ourselves? How do we keep our children with the gender they were born? They've really, you know, taken so many of these basic things from us. And it's time for us to figure out, to really take a hard look at what those are. And here are some simple, not easy, but simple ways that we can actually take them back.
What has feminism done to the U.S. fertility rate?
Well, I think it's fairly obvious what it's done. I mean, you can see that the TFR, which is the total fertility rate, like per woman, you know, replacement rate, is 2.1 children per woman. That keeps us above the death rate, the replacement rate. And I think that, you know, America was always far ahead in the first world. We were always beating France. We were ahead of Western Europe. People were always very proud, like American women are more fertile or more happier to have a little bit larger family than those socialist countries over in Western Europe. And now that's all changed. And now we are going down the same sort of death spiral as the rest of the world, the rest of the developed world. I think we're at 1.6 after the pandemic, which is not sustainable. And you can see the results of feminism in other countries too, like third world countries in South America and Central America that had traditionally very high fertility rates. Those are now plummeting also. The spread of feminism, just like the spread of globalism, kind of homogenizes everything, and more women go to work and more women are told that their only value, not just their main value, but their only value is as a worker, is as a contributor to the global economy. And to remove yourself from that and choose to take some time off to have a family, to have not just one, but maybe two or three or more children, is considered almost a crime against a globalist order. And that is the fruit of feminism. That's where we are now.
Why did feminism consider sexual liberation as necessary for political liberation?
I think because women, when they are engaged in sort of traditional relationships with a husband or to their children, they have a lot to protect. You have a lot to conserve. The nuclear family is an extremely powerful small unit that does operate at the sort of micro level of like a country. You know, there's rules, there's laws, you have your own little fiefdom, your own little home. And it can be hard for government and sort of these new critical rule ideologies to penetrate that protective bubble. So it's necessary for them to break it up. You know, it's like when you break the nucleus of an atom, it causes an explosion. And it's similar with the nuclear family. If you think about it just as like physics, when you break it up, it explodes everything else. You know, the people in it now are sort of free floating isotopes randomly moving through society. And they're much easier to grab, to target, and to attract them to these sort of new ideologies that are, you just become another sort of obedient voter for whatever they want you to do. And it's really nefarious and quite dangerous. And I mean, that is why they want to break up the family so badly. And you can see now what they're doing, accessing children. The kids seem to be the sort of soft underbelly of every family now.
We talk about feminism coming in waves. What is and who are the fourth wave feminists?
Yeah, the fourth wave, I like to say, are, you know, the third wave is sort of like the, you know, the boomers, the hippies. The fourth wave is the intersectional wave of feminism. So it's no longer, you know, white feminists are now really considered out. They're part of the patriarchy. And new fourth wave feminists have found women that they like better than you. And those women are men. And so really fourth wave feminism gave birth to the transgender movement, which has as we can see right now, June has really been superpowered, supercharged. It is everything now. I mean, if you're in a corporation, if you work for a big corporation, you are no doubt right now going through struggle session after struggle session. I have a friend who works at a huge company, and there's 50 events on the intranet calendar for her to do this month, different various ally Zoom meetings and making sure you show your allyship at every point. And it's really remarkable how far they've taken this. They've taken this all the way.
In that vein, this week, John Hopkins University defined a woman as, quote, non-man. Does that surprise you?
Yeah, they keep coming up with these funny euphemisms for women. You know, they had uterus haver, but then they realize, oh, wait, whoops, that excludes all the every trans woman. You can't be defined by body parts. So they're trying to define a biological gender as what you're not. But with non-men, and J.K. Rowling was tweeting about this, that man doesn't need a new definition. So we're being defined again by our comparison to men. There is no independent definition of woman. And I think because trans men aren't arguing for anything, they're pretty quiet in this fight. If you've noticed, like the trans men are not really, you know, in the parades. You don't see a lot of them in the media. No trans men, and what by that I mean a biological woman who has like a mustache, you don't see them on the Bud Light cans. You know, they don't need tuck friendly underwear. You know, their underwear still works fine. It's really the trans women that seem to have hijacked the movement.
Talk about what you call a multi-pronged effort to defeminize girls.
Yeah, I mean, we can see that they're basically, and I talk about this in the book, it seems like that young women are being given sort of two models of how to be. And the first is that traditional ways of presenting yourself as female, what we would call feminine, are considered dangerous. That is, you're just basically giving into the patriarchy. So girls are encouraged to, and so this is all really happening on social media, are encouraged to look more non-binary, gender neutral clothing, cover their bodies, cut their hair short. And this leads very, very quickly into actually becoming non-binary and becoming queer. I mean, I saw an interview with Bella, I forget her last name, but she's like a British girl who stars on The Last of Us. She was in Game of Thrones. She's maybe 14 years old. And now she's saying, again, this is like the problem of child celebrity. She's now non-binary. She goes by they, them. And she defined her sexual orientation as, quote, wavy, as opposed to straight. What is that? It's very clear to me that she's just trying to kind of not present herself as a white woman. Like that is the thing you must avoid. So femininity is you're required to strip it. But on the other side, the other option for young women is this hypersexualized, over-the-top icon. You see this with like the Kardashians, just a woman just revealing every inch of her body. You see it on the beach with the bathing suits that no longer have bottoms attached to them anymore. I don't know where those went. Being just like a normal, feminine, cute girl who's not exposing her whole body, but also not dressing as a boy, that lane has kind of cleared out. And that's what I talk about in the book, that, you know, girls should just be encouraged to just be a girl. That's like enough. That's like a political statement now.
Why do you say that beauty, chastity, and modesty are the three filthiest words in the English language?
Yeah, I mean, look, if you start talking about those to a group of, you know, 28-year-old marketing executives in New York, you'll have objects thrown at your head. If you even broach the subject of maybe chastity is a good idea, maybe dressing more modestly is something you should try, you will be stoned to death in Times Square. You can't say those things because it calls into question lifestyle choices that maybe they've made and they have to now defend, whether it's just being on Tinder for 10 years or the way they dress, the way they comport themselves. Modesty is not just wearing something that doesn't reveal your rear end. It's also sort of moderation in behavior, not being like a crazed, out of control party animal, not being super promiscuous. And to suggest these things, it has the stink of patriarchy to it, of just how your dad telling you to, you know, not go out late at night. They cannot abide that. And it's really sad because a lot of women, when they get into their 30s, get into their 40s, look back on their life, and they do have regrets. My friend Bridget Fetisi, who's a writer and comic, she wrote a great article earlier this year for The Spectator, and it was called I Regret Being a Slut. And she's now a married woman. She has a child, and she looks back on a life of, and she had, you know, addiction problems and substance abuse issues that led to, you know, her promiscuity, and she regrets all of it now. And I think that, you know, women were writing to her like Me Too. She had so many Me Toos. It was like a new Me Too movement of women who had been lied to that sexual liberation, doing whatever you want, anyone you want, the more the better, will lead to happiness, will lead, that's liberation, that's freedom. And those are lies. Unfortunately, women are only learning this after, you know, learning it the hard way at the end. And I am here to tell you, like, you can avert a lot of heartache by learning it early.
How has feminism taken men away from women?
Well, I think the first thing is that men have only been, not all men, but many men have been, only been too happy to be a feminist ally. Because look what they're being offered when women are all on the pill. And there's abortion readily available, and, you know, no one has to marry anybody who accidentally gets pregnant. Men can quite happy to take advantage of that situation. You know, nothing is going to railroad them into marrying someone they don't want to marry. They can go and just enjoy the bounty of available women with zero consequences. And so when I say feminism has taken men from women, I mean, men are now not in a marriage mindset in order to, like, be intimate with a woman. That is no longer required at all. And the women themselves don't want that. No one is going to chase you down, you know, with a shotgun or, like, begging you for a wedding ring, because that's not trendy. That's not, you know, the cool way to be as a young woman. And so a woman who finally does realize, oh, wait a second, whoops, I do want a man. I don't want to grow old alone. You know, by the time you figure it out, it's too late. And men are very happy to kind of snatch up the youngest women on the apps or the youngest women they meet. And a woman in her 30s, 40s, you know, she's now looking at dating someone in their 50s or 60s. I mean, there's a huge age issue that comes into play, because that's just hardwired biological fact. No feminist ideology can make a man prefer a 60-year-old over a 25-year-old. Sorry.
You say, my equation for happiness is pretty simple. Maximize your number of children and minimize your number of spouses. Explain that if you would.
Yeah, I mean, like, I recognize that, you know, people, life is messy. You know, things do happen. I mean, I'm a Roman Catholic. I don't believe in divorce, but I know a lot of good people who were left divorced through no fault of their own. Usually men who were kind of abandoned by wives who changed their minds or wanted a guy with more money or whatever. And so, you know, I understand that. And I think just that's my sort of, like, glib way of saying, if you can minimize the number of people that you marry one after the other, that's probably a good thing. I understand that spouses die, spouses sink, catastrophes occur. I understand that. That's fine to remarry. But, you know, having 3, 4, 5 living ex-wives or husbands is probably something you want to avoid. And as long as your number of kids can exceed the number of spouses, you're probably doing okay.
Peachy Keenan is our guest. We're talking about a normal response to feminism. She's author of the new book, Domestic Extremist, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. On the other side, where do abortion on demand and big fertility fit into the feminist agenda? Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University, Chicago.
Indeed, the quest for truth is at the core of a university's purpose. The liberal arts, illuminated by the revealed truths of Scripture, are powerful for equipping students for a life of self-governance. A disciple is one who follows the master. So what does it mean to follow Jesus? He said that it means to take up one's cross. The cross is thus the symbol of dying for others, of dying to self for the sake of serving others. And a life of service is a life well lived.
Truth, freedom, vocation. Concordia University, Chicago. CUChicago.edu.
Welcome back. We're talking about a normal response to feminism with Peachy Keenan, author of the new book, Domestic Extremist, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. Peachy, where do abortion on demand and big fertility fit into the feminist agenda?
Well, I think we all recognize, at least people on the right, recognize that the whole thing has been underwritten by the abortion industrial complex. You know, it really does feel like there's this big safety net built under a woman's life. It's like a huge scaffolding that's there to catch her if she falls or, quote, makes a mistake. And there's no way you would be saddled with a baby, or as Barack Obama famously put it, we don't want you to be punished with a baby. So you need to live your life. And part of that is making yourself available. And it almost feels like the feminist abortion safety net is really constructed for men. And it's really remarkable that they are pushing this for women as a totally safe option. It's completely fine. This is female healthcare. It's like getting a mole removed. And the only beneficiary that I can see are the men who don't want to be fathers, never intended to marry anybody, just wanted to have like a fun night. And women are not able to see this clearly, that it is hurting them. It's hurting, obviously, the unborn child that will never get to be born. But there are after effects to it. You know, there's no other safe medical procedure that can haunt you in your dreams. You know, this is really the only one. And it's sort of criminal how feminists are now working basically for the patriarchy.
How does feminism target motherhood in other ways?
Well, I think that you can see this when you are, for example, a working mother, or if you decide to leave a job to go on maternity leave. I mean, this happened to me. I had gone back to work after my then youngest was in school, and I had a great opportunity to go get sort of like a dream job. And so I took it. And then I got pregnant about a year in, and I knew I wouldn't be coming back. I would see young women come back after having a baby, not that many because these are millennials and they weren't having children. And they would come back without their six-week-old. And I would say like, oh, where's your baby? And they'd be like, oh, he's in school. You know, they call daycare school. But the policies for going out they're pretty stringent. I mean, you don't get a lot of time. You don't get a lot of maternity leave money. You have to choose between feeding your kids, feeding yourself, or getting to stay home. And it's a very hard choice. I left. I went on maternity leave, and there's no way I would go back. I wanted to raise my own child. And you take a huge financial sacrifice for that. There's just no way around that. And so the whole system, the whole kind of double income trap, which Elizabeth Warren at one point did write about, she used to be kind of an anti-feminist until she kind of turned. She went native, so to speak. But it really feels like all these policies are just designed to get you back into the salt mines as quickly as possible, back into the coal mine. Leave the kid. Don't we'll take it from here. You know, we've got your kids. That's what Joe Biden has been saying all week. These are not your kids. These are our kids. So don't worry about it. And so feminism is really denying women their own maternal instinct. And I write about that a lot in the book, about how women's natural inborn maternal instinct, it's on the chopping block.
In that vein, what changed for you when your first child was born?
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, everything. I'd already kind of had a political conversion. I was not yet a Catholic. However, before my first child was born, we had suffered, unfortunately, a miscarriage at 3 months. You know, by that time, you can see the baby's body, you see the heartbeat, little arms and legs flailing around, you know. And so, you know, we went in there for the 3 month check, and unfortunately, the heart was no longer beating. So, you know, they had to extract the embryo or fetus. And it was so traumatic for both of us that my husband told me shortly after that he was going to convert to Catholicism because he had to deal with the grief. That was fine with me. I wasn't ready to do it myself, but I eventually followed him there. Then when I finally did have, you're not too much after that, my first child, it changed everything because, I mean, there's nothing to prepare you for the sudden, the level of sacrificial love. Nothing, not even getting married can prepare you for this like tiny creature who you would gladly throw yourself in front of a train for. Like there's nothing like that. It's so strong, so powerful, which makes it to me all the more tragic that women have been tricked into thinking that it'll be fine. It's better for them to separate from the newborn and go back to work. That's actually better for the kid. The kid wants mommy to be happy and make money. That's better for the childhood. And like, no, the baby wants the mommy. And the thing we have stopped thinking about is like, well, everyone wants to know what's the best for the mother. What's the best for the woman? What's the best for the economy, the country? But no one asks, well, what does the baby want? And we all know what the baby wants. The baby wants you.
Why then does study after study tell us that women are almost across the board less happy now than ever before?
Yeah, there's a study that I found doing research from Wharton that became pretty controversial because it tracked the gender happiness gap. And, you know, this is a study probably 10 years ago. And they were surprised to learn, the Wharton researchers, that despite all the promises of women's liberation would make them, their ability to become CEOs and find all this fulfillment at work and all the liberation, all the equal rights, why aren't they happier? And because they really aren't. Men are happier. Women have become less happy. And their reason was that with the push to careerism, women are no longer just comparing themselves to each other. You know, like now they have to compare themselves to the highest performing men in any field that they're in. And so that sets you up as, that's just like a larger pool to compare yourself to. And you may not match up. You may not have those skills to be like the best, whatever. And so it leads to this great unhappiness. And also part of it is these are women who, in terms of career women, may have frozen their eggs, may have delayed marriage, may have delayed parenthood in the hopes of rising in their career. And the problem is that a boss can never give you the affirmation and the love that your family can. And they're sort of figuring this out too late. I mean, egg freezing rates are at an all-time high, and so is antidepressant usage.
How is natural monogamous marriage a huge part of the answer to the ills of feminism?
Well, I mean, a woman who, you know, they've been told for decades that, you know, women need a man like a fish needs a bicycle. I mean, I guess it's true that you can live alone. That's fine. And women, people who say, you know, I don't ever want to get married, I don't ever want to have children, I say, you know, I like to quote Napoleon, never interrupt your enemy when they're making a mistake. Because I do think it's a mistake. I think that human beings are just naturally not really equipped to forge life solo. That didn't really work out in prehistoric times. The only reason we're here is we all come from a long line of extremely domestic mating pairs. That is why their DNA triumphed. They were able to mate to protect the offspring that they produced to feed them. And the only way to accomplish that really is in a long-term monogamous marriage. And there are so many benefits to it. If you know, obviously choose the right spouse, you know, I'm not saying marry like, you know, the bus driver that you got on that day, but there are so many benefits. And one of the crucial ones that's overlooked, I think, because people are so afraid of death and of aging. But I think about this all the time. You know, I'm Generation X. I'm not a spring chicken. Is that, you know, being alone as you age and being alone at the end just seems like a situation that I, for one, definitely want to avoid. And we're going to have a crisis on our hands now with all the single women, single older women, you know, as they go into, let's say, nursing homes or hospice or whatever, they're literally going to be so alone. And it's really heartbreaking to think about. And so I really hope people kind of think about how you want your end to be and work backwards and, you know, try to make that as comfortable for yourself as you can.
Is it possible to restore normality to our society?
Well, I mean, yes, that's part of, you know, can we win the culture war? People ask me that all the time because it's the subtitle of the book. And the good news is people want to win. People definitely want to restore normality. People want to have the freedom to be normal without having everything politicized in this very novel, kind of excruciating way. And yes, we can win. It's not going to be by next Tuesday. The left had a 100-year head start in tearing everything down. I basically think, you know, this year is sort of like the mop-up operation. I mean, they kind of won. Like, it's sort of over. The battlefield is smoking and there's like charred wreckage all around us. And we're all kind of like, whoa, shell-shocked. Like, how did it get everywhere so fast? But it wasn't fast. They had a long lead up. And so it's just about us finally waking up to this and deciding, okay, we're going to fight back in the ways that we can fight back. I'm not suggesting an actual war, obviously, a rhetorical war, a spiritual war, a war where normal people feel empowered to take charge of their own inborn identities, their God-given identities. They feel more empowered to assert their parental authority, to opt their children out of this. This is really not even about their kids anymore. You know, my kids, it's really about my grandchildren. I shudder to think what the world will be like for my grandchildren if things keep going down this path, if fertility rates keep plummeting, male fertility is down. Are we just going to be in this world of like lab-grown humans in artificial wombs and each baby has some kind of like, you know, melange of parents? You can just see that coming and it's really terrifying. And so I want normal people who don't want that to sort of band together. There's huge strength in our numbers. People are just kind of feel afraid at work to speak out. And I think I don't want anyone to get fired, you know, don't come out of the closet, and, you know, yet. But there's a lot of little things you can do. You can focus on where your children go to school, if you should homeschool, have an extra child, you know, recommit yourself to your family, to your community of friends, and to your parish.
Peachy Keenan is a married mother of five in Southern California, senior contributor for The Federalist and contributing editor for The American Mind, and author of the new book, Domestic Extremist, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Peachy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
When we come back, it's part two of a retrospective on the Lutheran battle for the Bible. Dr. Ken Sherb, editor of the new book, Rediscovering the Issues Surrounding the 1974 Concordia Seminary Walkout, will be our guest.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Memoria Press award-winning Latin programs have successfully taught hundreds of thousands of students across the world. Their easy-to-use, step-by-step Latin curriculum provides students with an academic vocabulary, a mastery of English grammar, and strong critical thinking skills. If you're interested in learning more, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next purchase by using the coupon code LPR23. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Continuing education for the confessional Lutheran. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. AdGruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at AdGruesome.com. That's AdGruesome.com.
Register today. The 2023 Lutherans for Life National Conference is October 11th through the 13th at the Holiday Inn Cincinnati Airport in Erlanger, Kentucky. The conference includes visits to the Ark Encounter and Creation Museum. Online registration is open now with early bird pricing at lutheransforlife.org/conference. Lutherans for Life, equipping Lutherans and their neighbors to be gospel-motivated voices for life. lutheransforlife.org.